This week on the Dragzine Podcast, I talk with Bill Bader, the owner of Summit Motorsports Park, about what it takes to run a drag strip, how to grow the sport of drag racing, and the good old days when things used to be a lot of fun. So, pull those belts tight. Get ready to put into the beams. The Dragzine Podcast starts now. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Dragzine Podcast. I'm your host, Senior Associate Editor Brian Wagner. This week on the show, Bill Bader stops by and get to hear some interesting thoughts on him about what goes into running a track like Summit Motorsports Park and just drag racing stuff in general. Really, really interesting conversation that will kind of surprise some people, I think. So without further ado, let's get this drag racing party started. All right, my guest this week on the Dragzine Podcast is Norwalk, as we call it in Ohio, Norwalk, as it's probably more known as the rest of the world, Summit Motorsports Park owner Bill Bader. What's going on, Bill?
Good morning. How are you?
Doing good, doing good. It's getting to be that time of the year where racing around here starts to kind of wind down, and I'm forced to travel to other exotic locations like Valdosta, Georgia, to go to events and up to Bud's Creek for the World Cup and whatnot. But yeah, it's been a interesting year this year overall for racing, but I was very lucky that I've got to come up to your guys' neck of the woods a couple times this year for some big events like the Night of Fire and stuff like that.
Yeah, and in fact, I think you probably captured your photography of Night Under Fire, specifically the burning of the wall, was probably the photo of the year from Summit Motorsports Park. So congratulations on that, by the way.
I appreciate that. You know, that was my first time coming to the Night of Fire, which I was on Joe Costello's podcast about that as well. And I told people this is a... To me, that's a bucket list race officially. If I'm free that weekend, I'm going to be at that track photographing that event. But shooting that was definitely a right place, right time kind of deal for sure. And it was definitely – I didn't realize how the shots turned out until I pulled them, put them on my computer. I was like, oh, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, they were incredible. And actually, that is going to be that photo is going to be the basis of our – marketing for 2020, because it you know, we are in the entertainment business, and anyone who has figured that out, I think, is excelling. And if you haven't figured that out, I think it's very problematic, because people come here. Certainly, they're hobbyists, they're enthusiasts, they're racers, they're crew members, they're family members. But who doesn't want to be entertained when they travel somewhere? So that event, what's nice is that we obviously have professional racing. I mean, we have Fuel Funny Cars. We have all kinds of entertainment or all kinds of talent, but it's packaged with an entertainment idea in mind, as opposed to just running cars down the racetrack, which in and of itself can be sometimes very uninspiring. So, but yeah, congratulations on the shot of the year. I'm assuming when we hang up, you're probably going to send me over an invoice or something crazy, but we will, I have told everybody, about your picture. So, did that elevate your career to like international status?
Red carpets were rolled out, velvet ropes were opened. You know, it completely changed my life. But no, it's seriously, I've had a lot of people. I think that picture definitely has reached so many people, and that's kind of wild in a sense. And I think it also kind of tells the tale of what you guys do up there and how it kind of comes off as entertainment. Because we were kind of talking about this in our little pre-call segment about what. You know, I always refer to it as Norwalk because that's what it was when I was growing up as a kid. You know, we're all going to Norwalk. You know, at Summit Motorsports Park, that you guys, you know, there's some tracks that are known as, oh, well, it's only a heads up track, or it's an outlaw track, or it's a bracket racing only track. You guys do everything up there, which to me, that's, you know, speaking to the entertainment factor. You know, I look at what's going on up at Summit this weekend to see what events you have because of the wide variety of what you guys have and how well you execute the events.
Well, we talk about unique flavors in the ice cream chest, so to speak. We're known for our ice cream. So it's kind of corny, but it's true. How many flavors of chocolate can you have in your ice cream chest, or how many vanillas or strawberries or butter pecans? Those are all staple flavors, and we have staple events that our Edelbrock Super Series, our Test and Tunes, our Amateur Night, those are our staples. And clearly, we've never been bashful about saying that sportsman racing is what built Summit Motorsports Park. So clearly, we never take our eye off of sportsman racing. And by the same token, you can't run 100 of those events a year. So we have something for everybody. We have a huge Pontiac event. We have a pure entertainment event in Night Under Fire. We have a 72 and older street rod show called the Blue Suede Cruise that is approaching 20 years old. Our Halloween Classic, which is a giant 8-day party with a bracket race breaking out behind it. So we do. We have a broad spectrum of entertainment, and we always talk about, okay, is this a unique flavor in the ice cream chest? And if it is, great. If not, we don't want to in any way kind of cannibalize an existing event. So if we have an event and we have somebody that approaches us about doing something similar, we usually pass on that because we're already doing it. And so and that's a great place to be in. And we're very blessed. If I could ask for one thing, it would be to be in a drier climate. But other than that, we are very blessed here for sure.
Yeah, the weather this year for anybody in the racing industry was flat brutal. I mean, that was just across the board,
Yep.
it was just everywhere. I think the PDRA, for example, they had rain at pretty much it touched every event they had, and they actually lost an entire event due to, the hurricane coming through this past year. And I think that just speaks volumes about what people don't realize what goes on as a track operator, because, God bless the internet, it's helped us out in so many ways, but it also gives, I think, in some aspects, unfortunately, the village idiot, if you will, a megaphone to scream, and people are quick to bash tracks and they don't realize what goes into putting on an event or just a regular race. You don't just show up, flip on the lights, turning on the timing signal, and that's it. There's a lot that goes into these events for sure, right?
There are, in some cases, the better part of a year preparing for an event, and whether it is a so I'll paint a scenario. It's a nondescript Wednesday night. It's an amateur night. With good weather, we'll have 275 cars, 500 people. They're going to travel from as far as a 90 to 100 mile radius to come. And so we have a beautiful day. And then at 4 o'clock, we get a shower. And there's some other spotty stuff out to the west. And it's remarkable how sometimes strategic rain can be. And I've said a million times, if it's going to rain, just rain. If it's not going to rain, then don't rain. But the inopportune timing of rain. So here you are at 4 o'clock. You start racing at 8. You're looking at 2 hours of dry time, on average, to dry a racetrack. Your attendance just got cut in half. Okay, so now you're going to be lucky to get half as many cars and half as many people. We've built for event X, and now we've got event Y. You've got people that are outside of 60 miles away that have already they're already en route to you, and you throw the gates open at 5 o'clock, and you've got rain scheduled at 6 and 7, and so let's say we get rain at 6 or 6:30. It's going to take. And it stops at 7. It takes 2 hours to dry. So now all of a sudden you're at 9 o'clock, It's a school night. It's a work night. There and so we're supposed to try to anticipate from 2 o'clock on what the next 6 to 7 hours is going to bring. And you know, even though I've been doing this 42 years, and even though it's just a Wednesday night, it's just $10 race or watch, you can really get hammered or talked about in a negative fashion if someone feels you don't handle that properly. So that is a relatively simple event. You know, by comparison, you look at the Summit Racing Equipment NHRA Nationals and what we went through this year and the mobilization and the planning and the coordination and the last minute, jumping through hoops and shifting gears. There isn't a track operator in the world that relishes that position. There isn't a track operator in the world that doesn't want to race. There isn't a track operator in the world that doesn't want to throw his gates open and make money. But those are the things that you try to anticipate, outthink. You know, it's like if you remember in the movie Twister, the lead male character walks outside and looks at the sky and he picks up dirt and he lets it drop through his fingers and he's trying to anticipate, you know, where the next tornado is going to be and what path it's going to take. At the end of the day, I've had situations here where there's been 100% chance of rain and we haven't gotten a drop. I've had other situations where there was no threat of rain. The map is completely clear and it's rained all day. Low-lying cloud cover, you know, just goofy stuff that we're near the lake. So from a track operator's perspective, you know what, you can only do the best you can do. And now the difference is track operator X that basically deals with that and says, hey, it is what it is. Sorry, I did the best I could. Or the track operator who identifies all of the moving parts and all of the hardships that his customers go through to try to come to your facility. And, you know, you make a bad call or you make a late call and that's when you sit at the gate and you give people a gift certificate to come back at another event of their choosing as your guest. Because you know, this gets into the whole idea of what is the value of a lifetime customer. So take care of your guests. We make good decisions. We make bad decisions. But regardless, we always take care of the guest, and that ultimately will ensure your success long term.
Oh, and I totally agree, because I hold every track I go to anymore to what I call the Norwalk standard. And that's, you know, when you go to some of these different events, and it's crazy to see how different tracks handle different situations, and you get spoiled going to a track like Summit Motorsports Park with what you guys do, and it really shows through. And to be honest, most racers, we're not the sharpest knives in the crayon box, because we're going to come up with, you know, when we're determined to go racing, it's going to happen. And, you know, with the weather this year, we were trying to take my car out to test on a Friday night. And as we're driving to the local track, it starts to rain. And my buddy's like, so what are we going to do if, you know, it's still raining? I was like, buddy, we're on 71 North right now. There's about three tracks between where we are and where we could be. I was like, it's not going to be raining somewhere. And I know a lot of racers that do that will just drive until they find dryness.
Yep. Absolutely.
And, you know, the way that you guys operate there with your customer service pledge, how did you come about with that? Because it's very unique and interesting on how you guys treat racers and spectators. It's because I've seen their issues before and how you guys mediate and mitigate those as much as you can.
Well, it all stems from a basic principle that the guest is first. It is inherent in every track operator. Obviously, there's a profit motive. You've got to make money in order to keep your doors open. I don't know. Let's dispel a myth right now. I don't know of a track in the country, and I'm talking about a drag strip, that is just making piles and piles of money. It just doesn't exist, and that includes Summit Motorsports Park. So obviously, having profitable events, especially in a narrow window with which to do it. Now, if you're in a market like Phoenix, Arizona, where there's 300 days of sunshine a year, you've got 12 months to operate. We really have 4. To operate in, and the rest of the time it's rainy, it's cold, it's snowy, or some hybrid thereof. There is a profit motive. However, with a guest first mentality, you look past the event immediately in front of you and you look to the next 5,000 events. And so it is short term thinking versus long-term thinking. And I was trained, I was built to always look long-term. And so yes, we're going to take it on the chin today, but if every person that came to this facility is taken care of, if every person that came to this facility is made financially whole, they will come back. How many times do we alienate customers in our respective businesses and we don't even know it and they just disappear? And that to me is the scary part of the equation. And so Dad coined a number of phrases, the complaining customer is your friend. As an example, I have somebody that's never been to this racetrack before. They pull in. They have a bad experience, or they pull into another nondescript racetrack, have a bad experience, and then they hear advertising on the radio for the Night Under Fire. And they think they've experienced drag racing because they went to track X. And so now they think they've gone to every drag strip in the country because they went to one, and they weren't handled correctly at that one. So the problem becomes, will that guest, does he or she say anything, or do they just disappear and you never hear from them again? And so I think probably one of the greatest mistakes that we make is that we don't think long term. The alternative or the problem with not thinking long term is that these racetracks aren't profitable enough to be able to sustain long term. So it becomes more of an immediate concern, meaning I need to get this event in this week in order to cover payroll on Friday. And if all of these facilities were well funded and well capitalized and we would be able, we wouldn't think so short term, but you know it. I mean, there are a ton of racetracks in this country that are paycheck to paycheck, so to speak, racetracks, and it's tragic. And so it that's kind of the prevailing attitude. We took a different approach, and listen, I've sat at this desk many times in many different parts of the year. Wondering how I was going to cover payables or how I was going to cover payroll or what. We all go through that, but it comes down to guest first. What is the value of a lifetime customer, and not ever getting those confused. Profit should be a byproduct of outstanding guest service. And we've had promoters that have come here that have embraced that concept, and we've had promoters that have come here that haven't embraced that concept. And it, and unfortunately, those events I weed out and don't bring back because I want my philosophy to align with the promoter that is performing in my house, so to speak. So that's where the Bader Family Guarantee came from. And the Bader Family Guarantee says if you come here and are dissatisfied, we'll resolve the problem to your satisfaction, period. And so we started assigning the Bader Family Guarantee to events that embraced a similar mode of thinking to ours. And we've had events that over the years we've had to cut loose because they didn't. And so I it is painful. It is a tough pill to swallow. It creates lots of angst and frustration, but take care of your guest. That's rule number one. And you know, you can't lose if the customer wins.
Oh, totally. And when it comes to racers, I've always said that, you know, we just like the three P's. We like to have, first of all, a well-run program, you know, good prep for whatever kind of racing we're doing, and the payout to be correct, let's just say. And pretty much, sure. I think at that point, racers will literally race anywhere with those options. As long as there's some place to go to the bathroom and some place to get a hot dog, they're good. They, you know, we will make laps upon laps upon laps until we're told to leave, period.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's true.
And keeping the guests satisfied, I think, is, you know, what's amazing and huge. And you guys have definitely had all kinds of different guests come through and whatnot. And, you know, 40 plus years of the business, I'm sure you've seen some pretty interesting stuff. Kind of shuffling through your memory banks, you know, what's one thing where it happened and you just, where, you know, you kind of take it aback and you just go, huh, well, that's a new one.
Oh, wow. That happens constantly. You'll have situations almost weekly. We had when AutoStart first came out, we had a you know, two drivers pre-stage, driver A stages, driver B has 10 seconds to do the same. We had a situation where we had a driver inadvertently turn on the stage bulb, I think for 0.6 seconds, and then the stage bulb went off, and neither driver wanted to stage, and their trees both went red. And it was, so I called CompuLink, and he said, well, it's a double disqualification. Well, it just so happened that it was in the finals of a $10,000 to win race. And of course, this was early on in the life of AutoStart, and people didn't really understand it. And they looked to the track as, well, you had a malfunction. It was simple for us. We just reran the race. We pushed them back. We cooled them off. I wanted a winner. I wanted a runner-up. But technically, it's a double disqualification. But how can you not have a winner and not have a runner-up, especially when it's a $10,000 to win race? We've had, in I don't know if you remember the year that Greg Anderson timed out at the Summit Racing Equipment and HRA Nationals. You know, there are a lot of people. I had a person time out during the Halloween Classic, and they still to this day, 10 plus years later, you know, still don't know how AutoStart works. You'll have situations where, gosh, I'm trying to think of extraordinary circumstances over the years. You know, one of the crazy moments, probably the one that sticks out in my mind, was this was when we were an IHRA event, or we were an IHRA sanctioned facility. We had the IHRA World Nationals. It was the Saturday night of fire. We had a rain delay. I announced our event, and so I went into downtime announcer entertainment mode. And you know, the Saturday of the IHRA World Nationals was packed. It was a sold out Saturday, and I don't know that people remember that. And that, in fact, that Saturday, most of those Saturdays were larger in attendance than a lot of our single days of our NHRA national event now. So we were packed, absolutely packed. I decide to do a foot race, and I'm standing on the track. I'm looking, we only had lighting on one side, and our lighting was probably on the substandard side, if I had my guess. I look up in the stands, I pick two people that are nondescript, and I just happen to pick one of them that was absolutely sloppy drunk, lucky me. And then the other one, as he gets closer to me, I can tell he has a prosthetic leg. And I'm thinking, how in the heck could I have picked two? I'm thinking, okay, hit the redo button, right, or undo, so I've got these two people, and the gentleman with the prosthetic leg, it can tell I'm uncomfortable because the track, they're drying the shutdown, the track, the quarter mile's prepped, and it's incredibly sticky, and so he looks at me, he grabs the microphone, he says, "I'm not handicapped, I can run," and of course the crowd erupts. And so I put these two in the stage beams, one in either lane. The tree drops, and these two are off running. The gentleman that had too much to drink couldn't run a straight line to save his life. He's just running, zigzagging, and the gentleman with the prosthetic leg, the leg came off in the middle of his running. Were you here for that? Do you remember that? Do you know this story?
I was not here, but I have an amazing mental picture right now based on how you're describing this.
Well, so this gentleman, clean cut, well dressed, he's in shorts and in a collared shirt. The leg pins at the knee, and he didn't put the pin in. And so from the knee to his foot, is the foot is stuck and sticking vertically up, and he's tumbling end over end. And he jumps up, runs back, hops back, grabs his leg, throws it over his shoulder, and hops to the finish line. And people went nuts. I mean, absolutely nuts. And of course, I, as the announcer, am just sweating this thing terribly, like, oh my God, what do I do? What do I say? And he then gave this post-run little speech about being able to overcome, really saved my bacon. He did not win the race, but he won the hearts of every person in the grandstands that night. And that is something I think about routinely. And people accused me of staging that, and I absolutely did not. That just happened. So that was one of those, crazy, crazy, funny moments, probably. We are presented every day with, I mean, racers, as a general rule, are incredibly creative. They will, you're right, they come to a track, they want a hook and race track, they want a reliable timing system, they want a reasonable payout, and they will run their car, they'll run their wheels off. But they do come up with, they are creative. They do sit at home, and I'm convinced after we release our schedule, release our pricing, and then everybody goes to work on how to figure out the best way to get in, the best way to navigate, the best way to, save on a crew member pass. Our events, I've seen people go to extraordinary lengths. I've had people rent driveway space along 18 in order to be one of the first ones into Linder's lot when we stack. I've had crew members jump out and stop traffic. I mean, it really is pretty incredible to what lengths orange cones, saving spaces, the creative way that people save spaces. I had a rule once, I have a rule that at select events you can't save a spot. And I was dealing with a spouse who was instructed to save a space for her husband that was over in Linder's lot. And I said, "Ma'am, you can't put cones out, you can't put chairs out." So she lays down on the asphalt and refuses to move. And so what do you do with that?
Yeah.
It It's just in like I said, I've been doing this 42 years. I remember clear back to the early days in 1977, 78, 79, the early 80s. Girls beer chugs and mud wrestling and the grease pole pillow fighting contest and the kind of Wild West. I don't know what I would call that era. I wouldn't call it dark. I would call it kind of like the Wild West. And then the sport evolved and it became a little more, I don't know, is legitimate the right word or professional?
Civilized.
Civilized. There you go. Civilized. I've had people scale up our old timing tower. When we had our old lights, we used to have people at the Street National scale up the light poles. I mean, it was, and I don't want to listen. It wasn't like this was Sodom and Gomorrah out here, but it was a different time. And the funny car fox hunt, the bikini contest on the track, the stuff, all the stuff that went along with that. And then we evolved and we became civilized and corporate America got involved and then things and then it changed. It became more serious. And the stakes became higher and guys weren't flat towing or in open bed trailers anymore. Now they travel in $500,000 rigs and I mean it's just it is remarkable. The evolution that I have seen in 42 years from where we came from to where we are now.
Do you think that maybe some of that uncivilized type of entertainment needs to come back to an extent to maybe draw people back in this day and age of electronic devices in your face to, make it a spectacle like it used to be?
I think so. I think we have, as an industry, have gotten stuffy. I think we're uptight. We have all of these crazy rules and regulations and stipulations and we have rule books and conduct codes I think we have. I mean, as I'm sitting here having this conversation, the overwhelming sense I have sitting here with a smile on my face is how much fun that used to be. And it was like we all grew up and now we have to be adults. I look at, okay, so why did that happen? Well, money got involved. Winning became a bigger deal. Used to race for a trophy, and in class runoffs, you had a trophy and our announcer, Ski Pico, was just telling the story. If you, in the old days when you used to win class at Norwalk, my dad used to give racers $2 if they wanted to turn the trophy back in. So you ran for class, you got your class trophy. A lot of guys probably had a million of those sitting around, so my dad would pay him $2, buy the trophy back, and he would use it next week. And so now, in the age of these extraordinary big money races, guaranteed $1 million races. I think we now have three of them next year. We have forgotten that this started out as being fun. I think, and I think everybody's forgotten that. And I look at John Force. I think when John won his, what was it, his 150th race, and he used some inappropriate language in the TV interview. That was John having fun. That was raw emotion. That was pure joy and adulation. And so we're going to find the guy, or threaten to find the guy, and then he jumps over the fence and nosedives into the gravel and runs up and is with the fans. We have gotten definitely too uptight, and I think there is a way to produce a professional show and still have fun. I mean, that's what the Night Under Fire is. That show is scripted to the minute. I mean, that is a professionally produced show, but it's fun. And it invites the fan in, and we ask, I mean, there's fan involvement and there's fan applause. When was the last time somebody stomped their feet, or did the wave, or exhibited anything outside the norm at a national event?
Oh yeah, you
They're all
just
sit.
you don't see it
They're
anymore.
all sitting there.
Yeah, and I think to part of that is, you have someone like, Steve Torrance, who isn't beholden to a corporate sponsor, and he, just kind of does his own thing. And that's what I think attracts a lot of people to it. And I'm fortunate I get to go to a lot of different events. You see that the dirt track world, where I've covered some stuff in there, especially in the small tire and kind of outlaw racing world, where it still has that certain level of rawness to it, and it pays off. The no prep world too, they pack the house with people that are there for a show. They're there to you see the TV personalities. It's like back in the day when people used to root for their favorite car with a name. That's what they want to see. They want to have, it's professional wrestling with engines, and it's that's what it's come that's what it needs to go back to.
It really does. I think in everyone's attention. Well, think about what caused that cost. It was driven by cost. They needed to offset cost, so they needed corporate sponsorship. And in their attempt to, or within their success of securing corporate sponsorship, then there became a different code of conduct. At least a perceived code of conduct. And so now we've got this homogenization, or this these cars that are vanilla and corporate. They're rolling billboards. And go back, and I'm sure you're a student of the sport. Go back and read some of the books that were written, or some of the commentary about the behavior back in the day. I mean, the Bounty Hunter and some of Conrad's exploits when he was match racing, or some of the tracks that John Force, managed to get down back in the day when he was, that was race money. Those guys match raced to survive, and they somehow managed to figure out how to get down those racetracks. Now I've got a $1.6 million surface that has every bell and whistle, that is prepped beautifully, and now guys are smoking the tires. I mean, what happened? What happened? Hell, we didn't even have traction compound at one point, but it became serious. It became corporate. It became about winning. It became the joy of driving your hot rod took a back seat to the need to win, to either survive, feed your family, retain a sponsor, or gain credibility and notoriety. And I suppose that's human nature, but I think that translates to the guest experience in the grandstands. They know. Listen, I've seen it. The professional teams that come to Night Under Fire are in a completely different frame of mind than when they're here for the national event.
Oh, totally, totally different.
And that translates to the guest experience. Yeah, it's a problem. And it's, in fact, I would call it an industry crisis. And we better figure out how to figure it out, or we're never. I describe drag racing as in the infancy phase of its product life cycle. If you're a marketer, there's infancy, growth, maturity, decline. We're a baby. We're in the infancy phase of our product life cycle, and which means we have no place to go but up, and yet we continue to become a sport that doesn't realize its potential. And I hope to God in my lifetime that changes, because that would to me be the greatest tragedy or travesty of all, because we've got so much potential. There is such a demand for what we do. It's an extreme sport. It's a sport that feeds the mind of a short attention span audience. It's everything is right about what we do, but we package it all wrong. And we better figure it out.
If I was given a magic wand to make some changes to the sport of drag racing, I think what I would absolutely do is take and wind back the clock a little bit and take some of those old school elements and combine it with some of the neat stuff that we have now and kind of create that kind of package. And I always, I've always thought that if you were able to go back to the day where you had booked in match races and stuff like that, sort of like the Night Under Fire, even if it was like a four car, pro mod-ish shootout with some bright personalities, you can draw people in on your typical bracket race night where it's like, the old dog and pony show, Saturday, be there. You're bringing people in where it's like, we got a wheel stander, we got matchmaking pro mods, crazy motorcycles, and people go, well, I kind of want to go see what's going on just to see it. And it's those personalities are drawing. That's like someone like, Stevie Jackson, what he's been able to do and kind of draw people in, because he is just that. He is just a, to me, he's John Force 2.0. He's a new version of an old trick that has an edge to it that the sport needs to latch onto a little bit more.
Yep, absolutely. I think one of the things that, think about NASCAR, think about how many times the M&M car, think about those interviews, think about the helmet tossing, think about the fist throwing, I mean, NASCAR, despite, so NASCAR suffers its greatest loss in the passing of Dale Earnhardt Sr. And so Dale Earnhardt is gone, and the sanctioning body becomes about safety, and they become about restrictor plates, and they become about the car of tomorrow, and the foreign car entities enter NASCAR. And I mean, watch a NASCAR race. Look at what's going on. Motorsports is, by its very nature, a bit uncivilized, and it's volatile and it's dangerous, and there are, I mean, you can die. I mean, tragically, it happens. It doesn't happen often by the grace of God, but it happens. And so we look at, when was the last time there was a controversy in drag racing? A real controversy. I mean, I don't know what, do you have anything that pops in your head?
I mean, as far as like rivalries and stuff like that, at the absolute top level, I mean, just shooting from the hip, maybe, when Force was, John with different people, but it wasn't any, there hasn't been anything like that in a while where it's like there's tension when two racers line up. You know,
Correct. I mean,
you don't have it.
no, there is no Al Hoffman. There is no Chuck Etchells. There is no Doug Zilla. And I love those guys. I'm not bashing those guys at all. We have no black hats. Everybody loves everybody. When two guys, when two, we have no rivalries. The last time that there was emotion was John Force and Tony Pedregon in the on the return road at the U.S. Nationals, and that was how many years ago? Unfortunately, our guys all love each other, and they all hug each other, and they're all excited for each other, and they all and that doesn't necessarily isn't necessarily the case in bracket racing. It's not the case at some of these big money races. For damn sure, it's not the case. When we hosted Shakedown a couple of years ago, there was all kinds of drama surrounding X275, and all you had Duck in social media chirping about paying people to leave the track, and you had John Sears trying to maintain order, and you had the Bruder brothers being picked on. So within there was high drama going on.
Oh, I remember that
And
because I saw that conversation going on, and I was covering the event. And I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna st I'm not gonna stop and say hi at this point because that doesn't look fun.
but that was real. And it wasn't fantasy, and it wasn't, unfortunately, there were no cameras rolling. Unfortunately, it didn't happen on a stage. in front of all these people. But we have drama in our pits every week. We're not always able to take advantage of it. But on the stage where it matters the most, on the biggest stage, there's none of that. Why? Because we all need to be good corporate citizens, because whatever. So I think the idea of doing a reset and bringing some of the 80s and 90s and 2000s and merging them with 2019, and creating some of that magic. I remember, I mean, here's a story for you. I saw Shirley Muldowney deck Jack Ostrander and put him on the ground, you know, in my staging lanes at Norwalk. I love Shirley. Shirley Muldowney, I have a fire suit. The only fire suit I have in my office is Shirley Muldowney's. I absolutely love that woman. But Shirley was real. I mean, Shirley was Shirley, and the battle that she fought to get to the level of success was extraordinary. And that if she would have been a passive, easygoing individual, she would not have achieved this level of success. She needed to be a tenacious, you know, pit bull. So I think to blend the worlds. But I think that's true with everything. I think you can always look back, and we always look fondly on, you know, as things probably get older in our mind, you only remember the good stuff. But I think it's also, the old adage, dance with what brung you. And I think one of the things that has made us successful is that we've never deviated from what got us here. In 1997, when Dad bought IHRA, and, you know, December of 96, January of 97, and I may be off a year, but it was in the mid to late 90s, Dad bought IHRA. He left in right around Christmas time, went to Tennessee, came home in early January, and in the matter of 1 month, and probably it was more like 2 or 3 weeks, he moves his office out of here. We sit down, we have a father-son conversation. He shares with me a couple of pointers, hands me the keys, and is out the door. And that was never supposed to happen that way. It was going to be kind of like a seamless transition, but that became a defining moment, and it became a defining moment in our company. Because there was, okay, there's change. It was abrupt. And what does the future hold now for Norwalk Raceway? And I think the smartest thing that I ever did was maintain the same core principles that had gotten us to 1996 or 1997. And that was that guest first mentality. You know, the Bader family guarantee, we're just going to take care of our people. We're going to take care of our staff. We're going to take care of each other. We're going to take care of our customer. And we just grew and grew and grew and grew, and by the grace of God, continue to grow. So, you know, you just dance with what brung you. You take the girl to the dance, you dance with the girl. You don't find a different girl. And in this case, there are probably some core competencies that have been lost over the years. And maybe we need to get back to some of those, which is what you're saying.
And to kind of go off that, you mentioned NASCAR, which is, I can't even watch anymore, but that's a whole nother different tangent we can go on. But kind of what someone that hasn't forgot who they brought to the dance again is dirt track racing, because I got to go to Eldora this year and I've been able to cover all of their major events. And I went to the World 100, which is, you know, the biggest one they have. They basically packed that place out. Never seen that. Yep. You know, there's 35,000 people there probably. They're 50-50 on Saturday night. The person who won took home $80,000, if that tells you, you know, how big that crowd. The person who won the 50-50 won more money than the guy that won the race. That's
wow.
And they pack it out. But the thing that stuck into my mind, besides the sheer amount of people, was how engaged all the fans are. They had their favorite racers. They were wearing the T-shirts. And those guys, you know, they have sponsors to a point, but the best one and one of my favorites is Scott Blomquist. He is that guy that people, he's the Dale Earnhardt of that sport. They either love him or they love to see him wrecked. And when he walked across that stage, it was an equal mixture of boos and cheers. And I was just kind of sitting there taking all this and hearing all of these people. And I was like, you know what? This needs to be brought back to drag racing. When they do driver introductions, there needs to be this kind of excitement. And we got to figure out how to make that happen. And
yep.
Again, the problem you run into is, you know, unfortunately, it's expensive to go fast. That's, you know, I see yep. it when I talk to these people. It doesn't matter what level of racing you're going at, you know, it's a very hard balancing tightrope to walk in. Some promoters, you know, have it going on and have it figured out, and some don't. And it's to me, it's something that at the track level these days, with the technology that you have at your fingertips between social media and YouTube, you should be able to find ways to bring people in and put butts in seats. You got to be innovative.
Yep. Yep. You got to be innovative. You've got to be creative. And you've got to do the work.
Yeah.
And you know, getting back to the, and I hate to harp on this, but you've got a lot of racetracks that are very shallow in the staff department because money doesn't allow depth. And so who's going to do that work? Who's going to, and when I talk to tracks, one of the things I'll say is that oftentimes there is somebody in your pit area that A, is an enthusiastic fan, that B, has some tech background, and engage them. Let them in for free. Do something to create some type of social interest in what's happening at your racetrack. But again, so many of us are focused on doing what we need to do to survive that here's the difference. In the old days, there were promoters, and by the very name, they were able to promote. Now there are track operators, and a track operator is not a promoter.
No.
A track operator is their strength is in operations. Their strength is in I don't know, facility management. Too many of our racetracks have been taken over by track operators and not promoters. And in lies, as I'm sitting here saying that, I'm thinking, wow, that's quite a distinction, you know. And they're different. They're different animals, for sure.
You don't see them out there wearing tuxedos with a mic in their hand, right?
No, probably not, unfortunately.
No, it's the fun that you guys bring to the track and what brings people in. And, you know, your media coordinator, Mary, you know, I've got to know her, and she, you know, work with her quite a bit. And the fun that you guys have up there, one of my favorite stories is, I think it was during one of those weather down times, you know, at the shakedown that we seem to love to have up there. And, you know, you're trying to find a way to entertain the crowd, and you said something about, I got an announcement to make. I'm, you know, the owner of Trick Flow Heads. He's the new owner of the track, yada, yada, yada. And all of us that were in the media center immediately popped up and went to Mary. We're like, what's the scoop on this? Can you give us a quote? And Mary just had this look on her face like, I don't know what's going on, but I need to figure it out right now. And and it was at that point I learned about your propensity to play practical jokes on people. And it was just the look on her face and just how all that went down. And, you know, the entertainment factor of it was definitely it was one of those moments where I was like, all right, this is some funny stuff right here going on.
Sure. Well, and I think we do need to have a sense of humor. I think it should be fun. I mean, I think what guy, what gal, what family doesn't, I mean, the whole purpose, right? Automobile racing, having a fun car, having a street rod. I mean, it was all designed. It was all predicated on the idea of fun. And I think we get consumed. Well, I mean, I suppose you think about it, a guy can be 004 dead on with a one five thou package and he loses. And so he takes his $100,000 race car back to his $500,000 hauler where he's got all of his spare motors. And I think we all better remember that this is supposed to be fun. During the Halloween Classic, one day was token joke day where everybody got to submit jokes and we kind of relax the language on the PA a little bit. One day is limerick day. One day we're all in costume and we're doing. I, for the first time in my entire tenure in this company, I was able to, between 7 and 8 o'clock on Saturday of the, it's called the Trick Flow witching hour. And so, since you mentioned Trick Flow, and we park every motorized vehicle, the place goes black, and we're all in costume, and kids go trick or treating. So for the first time ever, I didn't have a job, and so I walked the pit area during the witching hour. And it was extraordinary. It was absolutely extraordinary. The costumes, the haunted trailers, the haunted spaces, the amount of participation, kids walking around with pillowcases full of candy. It just, and this is at a racetrack, but when the lights went out, it could have been anywhere. And so I think we need to remember, we need to treat our facilities maybe sometimes more as a backdrop for some larger purpose, rather than, again, we need to remember we're in the entertainment business, not the racing business. And I think that would then lend itself more to the environment that you're talking about.
So, kind of going off of that, you know, you guys already have one of the best racetracks in the country up there. And if I was to give you the magical fix-it wand and say, here's your wand, what would you change about Summit Motorsports Park that would just be like pie in the sky? Like, man, this would be so awesome if I could make it happen. What would you do to your track to take it to that level?
I would have every available creature comfort feature, which means I would have all flush bathrooms, no porta-johns. I would have plenty of showers for anyone that would ever want to take a shower. I would have Wi-Fi in every nook and cranny so people could stay connected. I would have every, again, available convenience. I think it would be nice to have climate-controlled seating. I think it would be nice to have charging stations at every seat in the grandstands, so you could plug in your phone, you could charge it, you could charge a camera battery. I think if we had the ability to have in-car cameras or an app that allowed us to be able to capture all of what's going on at a racetrack. So while I'm sitting in the stands, I can hit a thumbnail and I can see a camera set up in John Force's pit area to see the thrash that's going on. I can go over to Schumacher's pit area to see what's going on. I think if you took the NFL Sunday ticket package and you put it in somebody's phone and they could have that experience live at Summit Motorsports Park and they could have every available convenience and they wouldn't have to consume data. They could do all of that through an internet connection here. And if they had a bathroom experience that was on par with Disney, I think if they parked on pavement and had well-lit parking lots, if we had main entrances that were grand entrances with turnstiles, so those are the things that I look at my facility and say, boy, we really fall down in all these areas. But the trade-off is we kill people with kindness and we love them, we engage them, we give them control of their experience. But we are all, look at the stadiums, look at Disney, look at the stadiums that people are performing in. Look at Levi Stadium. Look at AT&T Stadium where the Cowboys play. The indoor arena experiences, the NHL experience, the NBA experience. We just don't measure up in those areas. And I don't know that we need to measure up today. We have too many other things that we can fix about the product. But I do think those become, I mean, where do you go now and not get internet for free? Unless you're staying at a $500 a night hotel that still charges $11.99 a night because they can. You know, I remember, oh, gee, go to Starbucks and you can get free internet. There are areas that we are archaic in, and they're in the creature comfort features. So that's what I would change.
I was going to say, I'd just be happy if the track had some, you know, you already got the showers. So if you guys just added some misting fans for those extra hot days, that'd just be, you know, that'd be the cat's meow for sure. But
I can do that. I can do that for next year.
Yeah.
Misting stations. I can do that.
Yeah. The misting stations, I think, would just, you know, blow people's minds. But all that other stuff would be, you know, that would definitely take. That's like something that would be a luxury racetrack experience because, you know, growing up, I'm used to going to tracks that, you know, were borderline outlaw tracks that, you know, some of them didn't even have porta potties. They were pit toilets and stuff like that. You know, it's something that, you know, you have to remind racers sometimes, I think, how spoiled they actually are, that no princess, sometimes you're not going to get to park on pavement all the time. You know, back in the day, that, you know, that didn't happen all the time. But in the end, you know, we all love the sport, and I think that there needs to be a certain reset mentality with some people that, you know, you need to understand what we get to do, how lucky we are to do it, and to just enjoy it, you know. You know,
yep.
Every day is not going to be perfect. You know, there's some days, like you said, you're going to cut that perfect light, have a great package, and still get your head bashed in. Go back to your trailer, crack open a beer, and just be like, wow. You know, I got to have fun today. You know, the car's not knocking, smoking, banging. Doesn't have to go to the chassis or body shop. Just enjoy it.
Yep. Well, and think about this. What do you do? What do you like doing when you're not working? What is a hobby of yours?
Race car stuff.
Okay. Well, do you have anything outside? Skiing, hunting, fishing, vacationing? Snowmobiling, anything?
It's kind of scary and sad that pretty much everything in my life revolves around cars and racing, but outside of that, I do like to cook. You know, I guess that would be okay.
Okay, so let's say your wife buys you a 5-day cooking experience where you get to cook with the finest chefs in the world, in the greatest kitchens in the world, and now... So this is what you get to do. I'm going to draw a parallel to that. Here's a guy. He works in a factory. He punches a clock, and his recreation is driving his race car. So he comes to the racetrack. It's a 9-second car, and let's say he makes 2 time trials, runs first round, and gets beat. He spends a total of 27 seconds out of a 24-hour day doing what he loves to do. Imagine if you're on this trip and you get to cook with the great chefs of the world in the finest kitchens for 27 seconds. And in lies the problem that we need to solve. Because what they love doing is racing their car. And they do so little of it in the course of a 24-hour period that the rest of the experience must measure up. And so it gets back to, Brian, what you're talking about the fun. It's not about, so many of us have focused on going down the racetrack versus having that 27 seconds being a backdrop for a larger experience, and that is, bench racing and fun and all of the things that the cooking out and filling that other, I don't know. So let's say they sleep 8 hours a day. So if I've got a person that's on my property for 24 hours, what am I doing to entertain him the other 16 hours, less the 27 seconds that he spent going down the racetrack? And so it's a crude comparison, but it's true. So all of those other experiential things have to be in play in order to round out that experience.
Oh, and I think right there, just that little bit right there is something that every promoter and track operator needs to listen to about ways to entertain racers, their spouses, and their families when there's not racing going on. It could be the littlest thing. Like I've seen up at Milan, they have a giant bonfire. We're gonna have a practice tree challenge. Just stuff like that is what. It's what makes a racetrack into Racing Disney World. It builds that experience. And then you mix in something where the fans can do it too, and boom, you've taken it to new levels. And I think that's what, it needs to be part of the bigger package to make drag racing back to that, to make it uncivilized but polished and fun like it used to be.
You almost said make drag racing great again, didn't you? You almost took a Trumpism and applied it to our sport.
It's something that Wes Buck over at Drag Illustrated coined that a while ago, and it's a phrase that gets used quite a bit across the board. And it, to me, drag racing's already great. You can't make something great that's already great. You can only make it better and make it take it to another level. It's the challenge that as you put on an event, man, how do we top that? And you got to think of ways to top it and, take other ideas and incorporate them in. And I not use the word recycle, but you got to tweak them. You got to find ways to be like, well, you always say, think outside the box. And, I always say there is no box. Don't put yourself in a box. Find a way to do something totally unorthodox. And that's usually your answer. What's the craziest thing you could come up with? All right, well, let's make that less crazy, make it work. Well, Will, our time here on the Drag Zine podcast is coming to an end, and I love to give my guests their ability to do the best John Forrest impersonation possible and plug their sponsors and everything else going on. So, why don't you let people know kind of what's going on in the world of Summit Motorsports Park, where they can find you guys, and some the big stuff that's coming up, even though it's the end of the year.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the opportunity. I thoroughly enjoyed this. I can't believe that it's already been over an hour, but you can visit us online at summitmotorsportspark.com. You can call in. We have 26 full-time people that work here year-round, and we always have a human answering the phone. I will never use a automated attendant during business hours, so you can call us at 419-668-5555. If you ever have any questions or concerns, you can reach out to me directly. My cell number is 419-577-5210, and our goal is to ensure you have a wonderful experience. So if we ever fail you, please let us know and we will resolve it to your satisfaction.
And when can people find out when the 2020 season is going to be dropped?
The 2020 schedule is going to be released tomorrow. The schedule is done. I sent it to Mary and our management team late last night, and so she's crafting a press release right now, and it'll be released tomorrow.
And I've already got multiple events that I'm gonna try to make it my best to attend up there, besides the usual suspects. And the one that excited me the most is the PDRA coming your guys' way next year, and that's gonna be one heck of a show.
Yeah, it really is. I can they PDRA released their schedule last Friday, and I just started getting inundated during the Halloween Classic from racers, and I mean, I heard that 50 times, 60 times just on Friday alone. So I spoke with Tyler this morning, Tyler Crosnell, and I said, hey, you know, what is the feedback? He said the feedback's been overwhelming. So we're pretty excited to be a, you know, we inked a long-term deal, and we're pretty excited to be a PDRA host facility beginning next year.
My bold prediction for that event is going to be the largest top sportsman and top dragster turnout the PDRA ever sees.
You know, I think that's probably a very true statement. We are blessed to have a ton of those cars. One of my fondest moments of IHRA was watching the Friday night qualifying session of Top Sportsman and Top Dragster. I seldom sit in the stands unless I'm there on a learning exercise or critiquing the announcer. But I actually would sit as a fan and watch that round of qualifying on Friday night, because we had 100+ cars. The bumps were ridiculous, and everybody saved their best pieces for that race, and it was just crazy. So I'm guessing you're probably spot on with that, and I'm looking forward to watching it.
Awesome. Well, once again, folks, make sure you follow Summit Motorsports Park on social media and online. Check them out. Make sure, you know, if you're within an 8-hour drive of the track, I highly recommend you go just to check it out. And thanks for being on the show, Bill.
Listen, I appreciate the opportunity very much. You take care, and we'll chat soon.
For sure.
All right, take care.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks to Bill Bader for stopping by and talking Dragger Racing with us. And as always, may your reaction times be crisp and your win lights bright. Till next week, folks.